says the upcoming talks with the remaining JCPOA signatories will result in an agreement if the U.S. changes course and removes all sanctions on Iran. A senior Hezbollah official says Lebanon's future is not in the hands of the Saudis, and this amid tensions over Lebanese ministers' criticism of the Yemen war. And the UK giving France a deadline to withdraw its threats over fishing rights hours after the EU accuses London of seeking confrontation. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafi. Good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Tehran saying that the upcoming Vienna talks with the remaining parties to the nuclear deal could result in an agreement, provided the U.S. changes course and renounces all the anti-Iran sanctions. The United States, when it comes to Vienna on that day, if they have the right plan, if the right executive plan, and if they do away with their previous policy that's to keep the sanctions in place that the Trump administration imposed on Iran, if they do away with this, and if they do not waste our time and energy in Vienna with some unfounded reasonings to keep those sanctions, then everyone should be rest assured that an agreement for the manner in which the U.S. could return to the JCPOA and the removal of all the sanctions in a verifiable manner could happen ASAP. So we are waiting for action on the part of Washington.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says that the current U.S. administration's conduct has been at odds with its claims of trying to rejoin the deal. Khatib Zadeh says Iran has heard enough promises, it's not awaiting action. He stressed it was the U.S. that left the deal in tatters by abandoning it, and the Europeans failed to abide by their commitments. Khatib Zadeh also called on U.S. leaders to drop their veiled military threats against Iran, stressing that the country won't compromise on its national security.
The Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, got into trouble in May 2018 when then-US President Donald Trump unilaterally abandoned it and reimposed sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In January this year, when Trump's successor, Joe Biden, took office, he expressed willingness to return to the deal. Accordingly, Tehran and the remaining JCPOA parties, namely China, Russia, the UK, France, and Germany, began talks in Vienna in April. Six rounds of negotiations were held before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. Now, Iran's foreign minister has questioned that whether the US is serious to return to the JCPOA.
If there is a serious will in Washington to return to the deal, there is no need for all these negotiations at all. It is enough for the U.S. president to issue an executive order tomorrow and announce that the U.S. is joining the pact from the point where the Trump administration left.
On Friday, the U.S. imposed fresh sanctions targeting Iran's drone program, a move drawing a reaction from the Iranian foreign ministry.
The imposition of new sanctions reflect the completely contradictory behavior of the White House, an administration that talks about returning to the JCPOA and is following the same methods of the Trump administration by imposing sanctions, is sending a message that it is not trustworthy at all.
Iran's drone program, along with its missile program, is among issues that the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies say must be included in talks over the JCPOA. That's what Iran has time and again rejected, saying its defense program remains non-negotiable.
Iran's defense capability is a matter of national decision that is intertwined with the country's national interests and security. Therefore, no country has the right to speak or comment on this issue.
Iran says it is interested in continuing the Vienna talks, but the negotiations must be result-oriented and lead to the removal of the sanctions in a verifiable manner. However, the White House persists in exerting pressure on Iran to speed up the talks, a policy that Russia believes is unhelpful.
pressure on Iran to speed up will the experience shows that it doesn't help. Either you do it bilaterally or in the commission, or you do it through the IAEA.
Top officials within the Biden administration, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have admitted that the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by Trump against Iran has failed. However, despite the admission, the White House seems to be still following up that proven failed policy.
Tensions are escalating between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon following comments by the Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi about the kingdom's war on Yemen. In our news program show just an hour ago, we've discussed what soaring of ties between Riyadh and Beirut could lead to. The Lebanese foreign minister has defended Hezbollah after Saudi Arabia accused the resistance movement of not allowing the differences between Riyadh and Beirut to be resolved. Abdullah Abu Habib described Hezbollah as a major pillar in Lebanon and criticized Riyadh for not trying to resolve its row with Beirut through dialogue. Abu Habib was reacting to the comments by the Saudi foreign minister, who said that dealing with Beirut was pointless due to Hezbollah's dominance. A Hezbollah senior cleric also reacted by saying that Lebanon's future is not in the hands of the Saudis. Political tension between the two Arab countries escalated after Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi slammed Saudi Arabia for its war on Yemen. That angered Riyadh, with its foreign ministry expelling Lebanon's envoy and recalling its ambassador from Beirut. Time now to invite two guests and to get some more insight into this. So we'll have Mariam Saleh, our correspondent in Beirut, and also be joined by Julia Qassam, journalist and political analyst, and Machgara. And Mariam, let's begin with you. Tell us more about how the Lebanese groups and government and everybody else has been reacting to this comment by the Saudi official.
Well, we do have, as Lebanon is diverse, as it's all its political components, its sectarian components, religious components, it is also very much diverse on this issue. And we have a lot of positions that are backing Mr. Kordahi, who is considered someone who is pro-resistance, someone who was even sacked from his job before, when he used to work in the Saudi satellite channel, NBC, because he was supportive of the resistance after the liberation of 2000 and the war of 2000. Now you have this major support or this opposition to a war on Yemen, which he is saying is also pointless. He was referring to words that even were said by global leaders as well. We didn't see any diplomatic campaign against those countries. However, now we have Saudi Arabia really putting pressure on Lebanon. You have those groups that are pro-Saudi, very, of course, vocal with their support and their backing of Saudi Arabia. You have the former prime minister, Saad Hariri, Fuad Sanura, and Tamam Salam, in addition to the current prime minister, Najib Mikati, who want to see a way out of this crisis. They don't want the Saudis to be upset with Lebanon in any way, despite the fact that the Saudis recently had not been supportive of a Lebanese government, whether under Hariri or under even Najib Mikati. But you do have this cabinet does have support from Western powers like France and even the U.S. They don't want Mikati now to resign. The Saudis now are not going to be just happy with the resignation from Minister Kordahi. They also want to see a resignation from Najib Mikati. Now, Mr. Kordahi stressed to the patriarch, the Maronite patriarch, of course, met with him. He asked him kindly as to try to make, given his resignation, that this is for the national interest. Mr. Kordahi said, "I do not have guarantees. Do you have guarantees from Saudi Arabia that things will change in Lebanon, that there will be a better economic system in Lebanon, that this will assist the current government really making all these reforms that they have promised? If those guarantees are put into place, then I'm ready to give him my resignation." However, we don't have those guarantees, and this is why now his resignation is out of the question. However, with Prime Minister Mikati, he is in the G20 summit. He is making calls and contact with world leaders to see if there is a diplomatic way out of this crisis.
Okay. Now, Julia, let us know more about the differences existing between Riyadh and Beirut, and what is it about Hezbollah that Riyadh doesn't like? Hezbollah is a well-established, legal part and parcel of the Lebanese establishment.
Well, since the end of the civil war, Saudi Arabia has established their economic and political stronghold, essentially, over Lebanon. And this was accomplished through the connections between Saudi Arabia, Saudi capital, and the Lebanese state through Rafiq Hariri, the senior. Since the liberation, and then this is especially accelerated after 2011, when Hezbollah collapsed the Hariri government. Back, you know, years before, there was the success of Hezbollah in kind of forging together a unity government with Hariri. But back then, you know, in the days where Hariri was tasked even more with carrying out essentially Saudi orders in the country, Hezbollah had posed a challenge and an impediment to Saudi political objectives in the country. Saudi Arabia had supported terrorist groups and terrorist activities in Lebanon, and this was evident in the 2008 clashes with Mustaqbal and with Hezbollah, but also with the financing of terrorist groups in Nahr al-Bared in 2007, and with the al-Nusra and Syrian opposition, armed Syrian opposition that came into Lebanon after 2012 and 2013. So gradually, after this point, after the Doha agreement in 2008-2009, but especially after 2015, it became obvious to Saudi Arabia that they no longer could rely on their proxies in the Lebanese government to carry out the political objectives. And in recent years, there was a lot of disinvestment of Saudi capital from the country, the expulsion of Lebanese workers from the UAE, from Saudi Arabia, that really accelerated as far as 10, 12 years ago. So at this point, what Saudi Arabia essentially did was they, even just this very simple statement that George Kardahi gave to a television channel 2 or 3 months ago, was a pretext for Saudi to basically unleash its anger out on Lebanon, which has been a very continuous and accelerating campaign lately, as we've seen with the with the banning of Lebanese imports into Saudi Arabia recently, the kidnapping of Saad Hariri in 2017. Right. Saudi does not, is very insecure that they don't have the foothold that they used to in Lebanon, and are blaming Hezbollah as the main challenge to Saudi hegemony in Lebanon.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Mariam Salah, correspondent in Beirut, and Julia Qasem, journalist and political analyst in Machkar. I thank them for their contribution. Also, I thank you for this edition of the News Review. Let's move on. Today marks the third anniversary of the death of Amal Hussein, a Yemeni girl who died of malnutrition at the age of 7. A photo of her with a haunted look drew the world's attention to the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. She died a week after her portrait was published. Our correspondent has the story.
Her name means hope in Arabic. 3 years ago, a photograph of Amal Hussein showing her skin and bones sparked shock and anger across the globe. A week later, she starved to death and became a striking symbol of the catastrophic situation in the war-torn country.
The number of malnourished cases is increasing daily compared to previous years during the brutal aggression against our country. We expect that the number of malnourished children exceeds 1 million across the country. Amal Hussein was only an example of the suffering of millions of Yemeni children. What is the fault of Amal and these children who suffer from the consequences of the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia? It is the children who pay the price, unfortunately, under the coverage of the United Nations.
Amal was one of nearly 2 million children suffering from severe malnutrition in Yemen. With 3 years having passed since her death, the situation has not got any better due to the continuing food crisis in the country and the lack of medicines for children.
We receive patients from all governorates, including very bad cases that suffer from extreme poverty and are unable to provide the most basic needs of children with their medicine or food. The organizations say they provide everything, but what they receive is very little compared to what they need. And it is difficult to get medicines for malnutrition. Some parents get forced to leave the center before the treatment ends, and as a result, a large number of children die, as what happened to the child Amal Hussein back in 2018.
The years-long Saudi rule and siege on Yemen have killed tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, where more than 20 million people rely on aid. Amal has died, but the hope is still alive for millions of Yemeni children who continue to suffer from the consequences of the ongoing brutal Saudi rule. However, the international community, including the United Nations, has not taken any action to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the war-ravaged country. Yalblatif Roshali, Sana.
The UK has given France a deadline to withdraw its fishing-related threats against London, saying it would otherwise look at legal actions. British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss called the French behavior unfair, saying that Paris should back down on its threats in the next 2 days. French officials have announced that they would adopt restrictive fishing measures against London on the 2nd of November if French fishermen aren't granted more access to British waters. Prime Minister Johnson had earlier said that his country's stance toward a fishing dispute with France remained unchanged. He had urged Paris to de-escalate the rhetoric. Meantime, the European Union has accused the UK of seeking confrontation and refusing to engage with Brussels' post-Brexit proposals. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
an official in the previous administration delivered a report to me recently showing that the hidden subsidies for oil in the year 1399 amounted to $63 billion. Well, who receives these subsidies? Who benefits more from the country's oil and petroleum resources? What I want to say is that such a situation sometimes exists. These are actions against justice, and measures should be adopted. We should do something to bridge the gap between underprivileged and wealthy classes. In other words, the resources of the country should be distributed in a fair way. As for the issue of combating corruption, this is a complement to the administration of justice. Corruption should be confronted. One of the grave plights that exists in the country, and that is the antithesis of justice, is the existence of corruption, economic rents, abuse of power, embezzlement, and unnecessary privileges.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes a person does an important job, and you reward him for that. This is all right, but sometimes some individuals have many special privileges. Well, why? The issue of extremely huge salaries is only a small part of this problem. Fortunately, in his responsibility as the head of the judiciary branch, the Honourable President dealt with this matter, earning him the people's trust and popularity. However, the main place to address this issue is the executive branch. The main place for combating corruption is the executive branch, so as to cut out the main roots of corruption. The judiciary branch plays a secondary role. After you make your efforts and adopt preventative measures, and after you destroy the origins of corruption, then it is the judiciary branch's turn to get involved if something happens. The conflict between personal profits and public interests, bribing, embezzlement, and the like, should be resolved in the executive branch.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, our program aims to address the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the US offer of humanitarian assistance to crisis-stricken Afghanistan and what it means in the context of America's 20-year-long adventurism. And we shall discuss a major crackdown by authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir in response to recent killings of the members of minority community.
Reports suggest that the Biden administration has agreed to provide aid to Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, which is staring at a major humanitarian crisis. On the face of it, the gesture appears to be altruistic in nature, but on dissecting the issue, it becomes clear that the catastrophe itself has been manufactured by the US military-industrial complex. Even before Taliban's dramatic takeover in August, the country was grappling with economic recession, drought, and the COVID crisis. And then came the freezing of assets and aid by the US and its European allies, which plunged the country into an unimaginable crisis.
In a classic case of manufacturing a crisis and then play-acting to resolve it, Americans have reportedly agreed to deliver financial aid to crisis-stricken Afghanistan, while refusing to politically recognize Taliban's caretaker government. It came after first direct talks between the two sides early October in Doha, nearly 2 months after the chaotic withdrawal of US troops from the war-ravaged country. While the US government has stopped short of officially announcing the aid, after two meetings with the Taliban officials, the European Union has pledged $1.5 billion in aid to Afghanistan and to neighboring countries, without specifying how it will reach the ordinary Afghans. It comes as decisions on whether to officially recognize the Taliban government and whether to unfreeze nearly $10 billion in Afghanistan's national assets held by the US Federal Reserve have been effectively put on the back burner. The US government blocked the access to Afghan assets immediately after the Taliban laid siege to Kabul on August 15th. 2 days later, the European Union also suspended its long-term projects in the country, leaving millions of Afghans at the risk of major humanitarian catastrophe. Since then, International Monetary Fund, as well as the World Bank, have stopped disbursing money to the country. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has warned of make-or-break moment for Afghanistan, with the economic institutions slowly breaking down. The US officials, however, remain indifferent to the crisis they helped create.
The full-blown humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan did not unfold overnight. It has been in the making since the US-led coalition forces invaded the country 20 years ago. On the pretext of nation-building, the foreign powers destroyed the country, fanned the flames of war, and eventually beat a hasty and humiliating retreat. Having failed to help Afghanistan become self-reliant over the past two decades, the US and its allies are now strangulating the country by freezing its assets. At the same time, it's hoodwinking the international community by making flimsy promises of humanitarian assistance.
Under the previous US-backed government in Kabul, around 43% of the South Asian country's GDP came from foreign aid, according to the World Bank. But still, as the former President Ashraf Ghani himself admitted in July 2020, 90% of the country's population lives below the poverty line, with less than $2 daily income. A report by the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in January 2021 noted that around 18.4 million people in Afghanistan, nearly half of the population, were in need of humanitarian assistance, six times more than 4 years ago. These horrifying statistics were published before the Taliban made sweeping advances across the country, and at a time when the US-led coalition was firmly in control. So, the question everyone is asking is, what happened to the $2.26 trillion the US claims to have spent in Afghanistan since 2001?
Did it vanish into thin air? Before the Americans and European froze Afghanistan's assets in August, they had for years enabled rampant corruption, filling the coffers of those who pledged loyalty to them. This gross misappropriation of funds was even acknowledged by the top US oversight body. So, the news about US or even Europeans offering aid to the country now should be taken with a grain of salt.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Ryan Dawson, an author and geopolitical analyst. Mr. Dawson, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's very important.
Now, as we've seen, Americans and Europeans have pledged aid to crisis-stricken Afghanistan 2 months after hastily abandoning the country. Now, do you think this so-called assistance should be seen with a measure of skepticism?
Well, certainly prudence would show that there should be skepticism toward this aid. And this has been ongoing even before the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. All throughout the 80s, the United States had intervened in Afghanistan allegedly to fight the Soviets, and they had aided different factions, and there's never any result from this aid, and they used it as a bargaining chip. They used food aid, for example, which they would take away if they didn't get the political results that they wanted. And so this aid doesn't come without consequences. Hillary Clinton is infamous for cutting off food aid, which forced factions in Afghanistan to start selling opium again out of desperation, which led to more drug cartels and nefarious things. Of course, during the occupation of Afghanistan, and that's what it was, when they annexed it for 20 years, the U.S. was protecting poppy fields, but that revenue didn't go back to Afghanistan. That revenue went to intelligence agencies, and which was used as black budgets to finance terrorist groups like ISIS in Syria.
Now, Mr. Dawson, it was the U.S. government that initiated the talks with the Taliban last year without taking the Kabul government on board. So why is Washington now justified in freezing $10 billion of Afghan assets?
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't part of the negotiations. Of course, there's different administrations. So the Trump government sat down and had negotiations with the Taliban. And the Taliban did stop attacks on U.S. targets, and the U.S. stopped attacking the Taliban. So there was peace in Afghanistan so long as people upheld the agreement. Nowhere was it said, oh, later after we leave, we're going to freeze all your assets because you're not the government we really want. We were hoping the Afghan nationals that we were supporting were going to... It shouldn't be up to the United States to decide which government is in Afghanistan or not, first of all. It's not up to an outside power. That's supposed to be up to the people of Afghanistan. And when it's not, even with their civil war, what have you, the U.S. cannot be picking winners and losers in this, which it tried to do. And for 20 years, they wasted trillions of dollars, trillions with a T. Imagine if they spent a fraction of that on actually helping people in Afghanistan through charities or third parties, something that's not government. But that's not what happened. But they made a deal with the Taliban, and then the administrations did change. But I don't know if the old administration would have upheld the deal either. But as it is, the Biden admin comes in, reneges on the deals they made, and says, we're going to freeze $10 billion. Why do they even control that much is another question. But they're going to freeze their assets. Now, they can do it based on power and based on the bully pulpit. But if you're asking, can they do that? Yeah, they can. They have the ability to. Should they be allowed to do that? Of course not.
Mr. Dawson, one last question. Now Afghanistan is today staring at a humanitarian crisis or catastrophe. Do you think part of the blame should be shared by the U.S. and its European allies?
They are partly to blame. They left weapons caches out for whomever. And their behavior, first of all, is an act of terrorism when you take a drone and murder a family of 10. Which finally got a lot of news attention, the final drone strike that took out a family, mostly children. That is an act of terrorism, and it also creates acts of terrorism as a backlash. And the drone policy and much of the house raiding policy and the double tap policy that they kept for 20 years in Afghanistan, which mainly did kill civilians, and in my opinion is terrorism itself, it's high-tech terrorism, will beget terrorism as a response. People who didn't hate or even know about the United States before is going to hate them now. Weapons of mass destruction that we say no one else is allowed to have, but that are used, cluster bombs and napalm and MK-77 and MOABs that the military did deploy in Afghanistan at some points, they kill indiscriminately. And they had very bad intelligence where, you know, one tribe would say, yeah, that's the bad guys over there, and it's just their own personal enemies, and the U.S. would run around, attack that one, and then, oh, oops, and then rinse and repeat. And then they had lots of green on blue attacks too. They need to just, they don't have the intelligence that was proven, so they can't do a good job of this. They engaged in acts of terrorism, whether they meant to or not. You know, if you drone strike the wrong car and end up killing a family because you got bad intel, it doesn't matter to that family. And let's be honest, this is not just all incompetency. If it, you do that a few times in the first year, you need to sort that out. And they never did. For a generation, they murdered people over there. So that is terrorism. And of course, it's going to create terrorists. But in their minds, they won't think of themselves as terrorists. They'll think of, I'm avenging my family. Well, certainly they've had a role in the humanitarian crisis. I mean, they supported drug lords selling opium, who became the little fiefdoms in their valleys. Not the best people to be in charge. And a lot of the healing that Afghanistan may have been able to do has been impossible because they've been in perpetual war for the last 30 years, really, including the Soviet occupations and then the U.S. occupation. That cycle of violence prevents the things that may have occurred in peacetime.
Mr. Dawson, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on this issue.
Medea Benjamin, author and founder of Code Pink, warns that if the US and World Bank do not release frozen Afghan funds, people in the crisis-stricken country will starve. Entrepreneur and freelance translator Noor Ahmed says $1 billion in aid cannot be a substitute for nearly $10 billion assets frozen by the U.S., demanding release of the money. Steve Hank, economist at Johns Hopkins University, points to corruption in Afghanistan fueled by foreign aid, says the country is at the brink of collapse despite billions of dollars in funding.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The situation continues to be fragile in the Indian-administered Kashmir after a fresh crackdown by the Indian security forces in early October, detaining over 700 people. It came in response to the killing of seven civilians, four of them members of the minority Hindu and Sikh communities. The cold-blooded killings have sparked anger and outrage across the Himalayan region, with the majority Muslim community unequivocally condemning it. However, many believe the police action against the members of the community smacks of abuse of power.
The summer capital of the Indian-administered Kashmir, Srinagar, was rocked by three back-to-back killings on October 5th. The first attack targeted a well-known pharmacist from the minority Kashmiri Hindu community. The second attack resulted in the killing of a non-local Hindu street hawker. The third attack killed a Muslim civilian. Barely 2 days later, unidentified gunmen barged inside a government school on the city outskirts, killing two teachers, a Sikh and a Hindu. In a separate but similar incident, two Muslim civilians were also shot dead. The spate of killings has sent shockwaves across the Himalayan Valley and sparked fear and unease among the minority communities. However, despite leading the condemnations, members of the majority Muslim community are again under the scanner. A massive crackdown by the Indian police has resulted in the arrest of around 700 people, mostly Muslims. The families of those arrested say the authorities are looking for scapegoats to hide their inability to protect the religious minorities. The sweeping action against local Kashmiri Muslims is seen as part of the controversial policy adopted by the BJP government in New Delhi since the abrogation of region's semi-autonomy status in August 2019. Pertinently, the attacks were claimed by a little-known group allegedly affiliated with the Pakistan-based militant outfit Lashkar-e-Toiba.
Following the revocation of Kashmir's special status under the Indian Constitution on August 5, 2019, New Delhi peddled a narrative of peace and normalcy, claiming that tourism has replaced terrorism in the troubled valley. But nothing could be farther from the truth. In the past 2 years, since 2019, not only have incidents of terrorism seen an alarming surge, authorities have used stringent measures to stifle dissent, detain political activists, intimidate journalists, and prevent political activities. In the process, the majority Muslim community has borne the brunt.
On August 4, 2019, close to 6,000 Kashmiri politicians, activists, journalists, and ordinary youth were arrested, internet was suspended, and a blanket curfew was imposed. It was a precursor to measures taken the next day when the disputed region's semi-autonomy status was revoked and the state was bifurcated into two union territories. The region remained under a communications lockdown for more than a year, even as unrest was quietly brewing. India's far-right BJP government claimed that peace and normalcy has returned, while rights activists decried arbitrary arrests of activists, silencing of journalists, and draconian colonial-era laws for critical social media posts. 2 years on, arbitrary detentions continue, public assembly is still banned, and thousands of youth remain in jails, including minors. Social media vigilantism has led to dismissal of dozens of government employees, while critical reportage by journalists has got them summons and arrests under repressive laws. While Kashmiri Muslims have borne the brunt of Indian government's post-August 2019 Kashmir policy, they have also been turned into scapegoats for security failures. The detention of over 700 Kashmiri Muslims 2 weeks ago and killing of a Muslim youth in South Kashmir this week, apparently in response to recent civilian killings, follows the same disturbing trend that has somehow been normalized now.
Now, to have more insight on the situation in Kashmir, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Khan, the head of diplomatic affairs at Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, there has been a spate of killings of members of minority Hindu and Sikh communities in Kashmir. Now, do you think it's designed to disrupt the centuries-old tradition of communal harmony and religious syncretism in the region?
Hello. One has to, first of all, condemn this because it is an absolutely not in the interest of the Kashmiri people or the struggle for the right of self-determination in the wider context of the Kashmir issue, Kashmir dispute, Kashmir conflict. This is a some kind of orchestrated, sinister move that can be attributed only to those who are in power in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, and particularly in Indian occupied Kashmir. You have something like 900,000 military and paramilitary forces who have practically over the past 2 years laid siege to at least 90% of the population of the Indian occupied Kashmir of state of Jammu and Kashmir. And let's not forget, Kashmir since the 5th of August 2019 has been bifurcated and is directly ruled from New Delhi. There is no local rule in the state of Jammu and Kashmir for almost 26 months.
Now, Mr. Khan, in a major crackdown, hundreds of Kashmiri Muslims have been detained in connection with the recent killings. Now, do you agree that the security agencies are looking for a scapegoat?
Of course, there is no legal or moral justification to the Indian government, this government or previous governments, to actually deny the existence and the bona fides of the struggle to right to self-determination in Jammu and Kashmir, because there are around 24 UN resolutions and UN charter demands that the right of the people of Kashmir is sacrosanct and that the Kashmiri people have yet to decide on the future status of their homeland. And therefore, the Indian state in particular, and in the wider context, those who are occupying the state of Jammu and Kashmir are always looking for excuses and scapegoats. And indeed, the communal dimension of this killing does not serve the interest of the people of state of Jammu and Kashmir, and therefore it has to actually be the answers need to be looked at the occupying forces, the occupying authority, the state that has the power and overwhelming power, unprecedented military occupation in the state of Jammu and Kashmir under Indian occupation is something that cannot be ignored at all.
Mr. Khan, the BJP government in New Delhi claims that the abrogation of Article 370 will bring peace and development to Kashmir. So how do you assess the situation in the region 2 years down the line?
Well, in 1949, the Article 370 was included or created within the Indian Constitution by the Indian state with agreement with the government of Jammu and Kashmir at that time. And the agreement was that India was only responsible for three areas, defense, foreign affairs, and communications. And India has since then actually ingressed into Kashmir and slowly occupied Kashmir and assimilated Kashmir. And abrogation of Article 370 means that since 5th of August 2019, Jammu Kashmir is an independent country occupied or reoccupied by a foreign power. And in clear contradiction of around 24 UN resolutions and also in agreements both between the Kashmiris and Indian state, which was engaged in temporary relationship, and between India and Pakistan. So therefore, India stands a state which is accused of breaking all the rules and all the agreements that it had willingly entered into at the international level and also in the region, and also bilaterally between the Kashmiris and the Indian state over the past 74, 75 years. And therefore, there is no justification whatsoever of the Indian state that it is a matter that it is internal to Indian state. It is not. It is an international issue. And so the excuses from time to time that come from New Delhi is just to reinforce its false and fallacious and also malicious policies against the Kashmiri people.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Khan for his precious time, knowledge, and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
India's Congress Party politician Salman Nizami denounces mass arrests in Indian-controlled Kashmir over 7 civilian killings, noting that everyone is not a militant. Muhammad Junaid, political anthropologist, says nobody was arrested when Hindutva mobs lynched people in mainland India, while in Kashmir, hundreds were arrested for murders committed by a few.
And that was our episode about the US trying to hoodwink the world through the flimsy promises of aid to Afghanistan and how people in Kashmir are living in fear after recent killings followed by a major crackdown. We shall meet again, same time, same day, next week. So till then, take care. We'll be right back.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali and Sayyid Abdullah Musa. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So this series of the program, Viewpoints, is mainly concerned with an analysis on the important points addressed by the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In this new series, we are concerned with the topic humans or human beings in the speeches of the leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. For today, we want to talk about an important topic, and that is the difference, or it's better to say the comparison, as it is between the Western democracy and the Islamic one, as the term that is coined as Mardum Salariya Dini. You know, when we talk about democracy in the Western world, the first things that comes to our mind is a secular political system. Mm-hmm. But when we are talking about Islam, this human dignity, you know, has come to the scene. But the case is that now where is the place of rationality in the, we can say, Islamic system or the system of values? So when we, from one side, if you are going to pay attention to obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with his own system of values, but from the other side, you have these human beings in the 21st century with his system of value and rationality at the top. So what are we going to do with the concept of rationality over here?
So I think it's pure rationality that we see in the philosophy that Islam has actually defined for itself. Look, Islam says the values are absolute, not relative.
Okay.
It means that if something is bad, so it is bad forever. Mm-hmm. And if it is good, it is good, and it has to be praised and respected. But but in the other schools, as I said earlier, they just look at a social aspect of it. They say, for example, this might be bad in a society, committing such an action might be bad in a society, but as for me, as a person, I practice it. It's because I'm free. Mm-hmm. So you see, this is the difference. Yeah. When you have no limitation for you, but we have these limitations defined by whom? By the Creator.
Okay.
Let me give you an example. When a car actually is going to be given from a company to a person who has recently bought it, what happens? The car actually has been tuned based on some orders and some formulas, and so you cannot say that I can take this car everywhere.
So different parts are assembled by the factory and given to you as a car.
So the vehicle cannot be used
in any way you like.
The person
that's right.
Who made this car knows how to actually put
the parts
together, right?
Yes.
The car itself has no idea for what has been actually. So the
you as a driver has no idea what's happening mechanically speaking inside the car. Okay.
So the one who has created you actually gave you a formula for your life, and he knows how to live very well in this world. So he is the creator. He knows. He is the person who made this person.
So now the question would be that, so this ideal system that you are talking about, Islamically speaking, might be practiced well at the time of its true practitioners, I mean, prophets and the infallible imams. But what about now?
So
I mean, the value system that you say can govern the people and has a system of values for the people in order to give them their roles and rights in the society must be, in a better sense, be practiced by true practitioners. I mean, at the time of Prophet Muhammad and the infallible imams. So
look,
what about now? Because the type of
Islam as a program has not been actually revealed for a certain period of time.
It has
been revealed for the whole mankind for in the course of history till the end of the day.
This is true. The value system is the same. But you know, extracting the new rules from that and adapting.
So even Islam is open in this sense. Okay. Look, up until the time of, for example, Imams, those who were present, so they were the real interpreters of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the Qaiba and occultation of Imam alayhi salam, there is the solution of ijtihad is open, and the ijtihad is something which is dynamic, and it is available every time. So those who are ruwat al-hadith, those who are interpreters of hadith from the language of Ahlul Bayt, those who we are calling them general deputies, okay, of Imam, they, yes, are eligible to interpret the hadith for the day that we are in.
Mm-hmm.
So they can easily actually interpret and give us the laws based on the Islamic values. And
also, can I add a point to that, though?
Yes,
now, what you mentioned is that you saying, okay, Islam is a system and needs someone to maintain it.
Yes.
So you kind of trying to imply the fact that we constantly need an imam or a prophet,
yes,
to maintain,
yes, yes,
it. Now, with Islam, there are two sides to it. Now, there is the government side,
yes,
where you have, you know, Allah appoints the ma'sumin or the infallibles or the governors of the system. But the system itself, it was made very clear to the followers of that system that you as a person has what we call wajibat, right? You,
yes,
have got compulsory actions that you need to abide by whether you have someone governing or not. So for example, now, whether the imam is present or not,
yes,
whether even the deputies are present or not, as a Muslim, I have certain things. For example, you know, if we go by the Ten Commandments, though,
yes,
I shall not kill, right?
Yes.
Though I shall not steal. These are set laws. I don't need, mm-hmm, an imam. I don't need someone to be in government,
yes,
to tell me this is my obligation.
Okay.
So Islam says you have certain obligations.
Okay.
Now, with other things, you might need to, you know, things to be explained to you and stuff like that. But the main things that when it comes to the rights of people, dealing with other people, they all just set predefined. Everyone knows them,
that's right,
whether they it is an imam or not. So Islam itself, so you can say it's self-maintained,
yes,
when it comes to the person,
yes,
himself. So now I know my duties.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes, okay, we can say when it comes to matters of new affairs and things like that and how I should deal with them,
okay,
in terms of halal haram, maybe I have to refer to a marja, I have to refer to an imam.
Okay.
But the basics themselves, they are set.
So then
so for example,
okay,
for example, if we, mm-hmm, do a comparison between Islam and the secular system,
yes,
or the countries that we,
yes,
have. For example, Islam from the beginning said there is no difference between a black man and a white man.
Yes.
From the beginning.
Yes.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala eliminate that kind of level between people.
Yes.
Now we still have that problem in the West, for example,
yes,
black people and white people,
yes,
until today, the 21st century.
Yes.
So as a Muslim, if I go back 1,000 years,
mm-hmm,
ago, my values are set in this kind of regard. So we don't constantly need that kind of government.
That's right.
Yes, it, as part of Islam needs that,
yes,
kind of government, but initially saying that as a person,
yes,
me and you, our duties are set and clear.
Yeah.
Only for the new,
sorry,
problems of Masa'il al-Mustahdath.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
any Muslim, he knows that he should not,
yeah,
kill, he should not take the rights of others,
yeah,
he should not steal. These,
yeah,
are set.
But you see, we have so many problems in the Muslim lands because there are so many interpretations out of a same fixed value system among different schools of thoughts. You know, the problem is here that in the West, in the secular system, as we call it, the democracy or the republic, the system of the law is replaced with the religious one, so the separated church and the state, okay? And that's the law that is ruling over the country. In the Muslim lands, in the Islamic schools of thought, now we have different interpretations out of the same system of the value. And still, the people are not ruling over the people. I mean, people from the same classes. Still, there is a government because, politically speaking, the system of the government and these political, different political positions are coming from the Western political sciences. And then we want to annex or cling a kind of Islamic value system to that so they do not come together. Still, the people are now ruling over the people. As you see in the
yeah.
Persian Gulf, you know, in the Arab countries, there's still the aristocratic king system over there ruling over the people, okay, in the Muslim lands. In Islamic Republic of Iran, we have this republic that everybody's vote is counted, okay? It's not like representative elect in the U.S. or something like that. The elites of the society decide for the people. But still, we have the problem of how to interpret